Rob, man, this week I would like to welcome to the podcast Trek Segafredo Pro Taylor Wiles. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Roadman, welcome back to another Roadman Cycling Podcast. Roadman, I'm super excited about this because today I'm speaking with Taylor Wiles. Taylor rides for Trek Segafredo, and it's the first time that I've interviewed a World Tour female professional on the Roadman Cycling Podcast. We've had a bunch of lads on the podcast from the World Tour. You know, there's weeks where we just had week after week after week of World Tour boys. And we've had a couple of girls, internationals, but we've never had a World Tour professional. And I can't think of anyone better than Taylor Wiles. It was an amazing chat that you're about to hear. Taylor is someone who started out her professional cycling career with peanut butter. She went on riding for Energy 2012, Specialized, Lululemon, Veloce Osram, Orica AIS, and then on to Trek. And she is an outspoken advocate for equality, sexual equality in the peloton. She is married to ex-Irish national champion Olivia Dillon. She is a laugh a minute. She's great crack. She's as knowledgeable about cycling as she is likeable and affable. And I'm delighted to bring you this interview. Before I do, Roadman, I just want to remind you about Patreon. It's over on patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. That's the place you get to go, and you can make a small donation to keeping this podcast on the road. The podcast is 100% funded from user contributions. So if you'd like to see the podcast moving forward, if you're getting a laugh out of this, and I promise you, you'll get a laugh out of Taylor's interview today, head on over there and keep the podcast on the road. We've built some serious momentum in 2020. We're only a year into this podcast. It's hard to believe given the guests we've had, but I want to keep building on it, and I want to get into better and better content. And, you know, at times I listen to podcasts, and at times I've recorded podcasts, and I walk away from it going, what was the point of that? Like, I didn't serve any point with that. Today's podcast is not one of those, and this is what I want to do. I want to get into the big chats. I want to get into the real chats, and I get into it today with Taylor, and I'll leave you with that now. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Taylor Wiles. Taylor, welcome to the Roadman Cycling Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Taylor, I'm excited about this chat. We haven't had, I think you could be the first female World Tour rider we've had on the podcast.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah, we've had a, so I remember I got a message about maybe like 4 months ago from someone saying, like, how come you don't have any girls on the podcast? Is it because it's called Roadman? I was like, no, I just don't know that many of the pro girls. I know a lot of pro guys. So then I was chatting to your wife, Olivia, and she's like, oh, you should totally get Taylor. And I was like, oh, it's on. I have to get Taylor.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm glad it worked out. And then hopefully now I can introduce you to more. I know plenty, obviously.
Awesome. You're my hookup now. I'm going to be melting your brain.
Definitely.
I'm going to touch on all sorts of weird and wonderful areas. And if you don't fancy a topic, just give it an all pass.
All right.
So you grew up in Utah.
I did, yeah.
What's that like? I had one teammate. I used to ride for an American Conti team, Stellis, and I had one teammate from Utah. And he was a nice guy, but I remember him just like indoctrinating me to how culturally different Utah is from everywhere else.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's crazy because there's a million good things I could say about Utah, and there's also a lot of just really odd things. And you know, you have the mountains and you have the outdoors, and there's so many national parks kind of in Utah and close by. And so I got to grow up, you know, I skied with my dad, and I always played soccer and was always outside, and that part was really nice. But the cultural kind of division in that that, especially kind of like the suburbs of Salt Lake City, I think the city itself has become more diverse and has become a bit more eclectic, but the suburbs are still very much super conservative. Everybody is Mormon, and I went to a high school where I think probably 95% of the school were of the faith, and I really wasn't. I kind of faked it sometimes so that I would have friends, but it was very different, and I didn't realize how different it was until I left, you know, when I got a little bit older and traveled around, realized that all the weird cultural nuances of Utah was not real life. And so
do you still identify as Mormon?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I didn't grow up as Mormon. I mean, I have some family members who are, but they're very open and, they've always accepted, like, it's mostly just my granny, actually. And she's like the sweetest person on earth. But yeah, I never really, was of the faith properly. I just kind of faked it to have friends when I was a bit younger. But it's an odd place to grow up in. I mean, I have to say, I never got into really any trouble because they're very strict. You know, there's no drinking, no sex before marriage. They don't even drink coffee or tea. Like, there's no caffeine. I mean,
there's no fun.
Coke,
no fun.
Yeah, zero fun had. Yeah, and quite judgmental. But other than that, I never got into any trouble. And
so how does that work? So I've obviously grown up in Ireland, and we're changing a lot in the last 10 years. Culturally, we're becoming, you know, a lot more liberal. It's a much more open society. But even, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, even like if I go back to when I started college, it was a much more conservative, Catholic-dominated country. What's sort of your relationship with the Mormon faith and being an openly gay girl? Do those two like collide, or did you struggle with that?
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I didn't realize my sexuality when I was younger. Like, I had some idea, but you know, when you're young, you don't often fully know what those thoughts are. And then when I got older, it was more seeing the way that all my friends from high school kind of treated me once they found out about Olivia. It was some, you know, still loved me just the same, and some I don't know will ever speak to me again. So there's a
isn't
bit
that
of
just
a,
so bizarre, like, I just I can't even conceptually get my head around it. Like, two consenting people do something that makes them happy, is of no concern to them, but it's exactly. Like, it pulls from their happiness somehow. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And I mean, I realize they are grown up being taught one thing. And, you know, the Mormon church has waffled back and forth with LGBTQ politics, really. I mean, at one point it was, no gays were allowed at church. And then it was like, okay, gays can come to church, but you can't be baptized. And then they did a horrible thing a year or two ago where they said, if you're a child of gay parents, you can come to church and you can be baptized, but only if you disavow your parents,
what?
Which was just awful. And then they reversed that because it got so much backlash. So they kind of change with the culture, but not enough really. And they're still, they backpedal sometimes to stay conservative. And yeah, it's a bit of a struggle. I mean, I have plenty of Mormon friends who are wonderful and who never treated me different at all. But then there's also the opposite, so it's a bit of both.
And when I look at the female pro peloton and I compare the amount of, you know, this is a very broad overview, it's not like I've analyzed the entire female pro peloton, but there does seem to be a lot of girls open about their sexual preference in the female peloton. You contrast that with the male peloton, who I think had
zero
gay riders, which
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like it's legit.
No, I mean, statistically, it's just, it couldn't be. And it's something that I feel really bad about, because, it was such an easy place for me to come out, because I came out when I was a cyclist and I literally had no backlash from the female peloton. It was treated like it was nothing, you know, there was no big deal. And That is really how it should be in all of society. Like, it should not be a big deal. Like, that is the thing. It should just be that's fine.
But isn't this an amazing part about female sport at the moment, which no one speaks about? It's whether it's soccer, athletics, cycling. The girls are so open, and it's so culturally acceptable to be an open gay female in sport. Whereas if you look across soccer, athletics, our own, you know, domestic sports in Ireland, hurling and Gaelic, cycling, like, I don't know one athlete who's openly gay.
Yeah, and I just think it's bad because it's the stereotype that is around gay men and that they're all put in one box. And I've even had conversations with male pro cyclists where I've asked, why don't you think there's any gay men in the pro peloton? And they say, I don't think they would survive. And I was like, what do you mean by that? Like, how could you say that you don't think they would survive? And they literally think there's no gay men in the peloton because they wouldn't be able to hack it. They couldn't be a professional athlete. And it's just so wrong that they would even think that. And
Because they're there already. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure, like, off air, like, me and you, I'm sure if we're having a few beers, we could go through the male peloton and go, gay, 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 gay.
Yeah, probably for sure. And I think this is changing. The culture is slowly changing, and masculinity is, being taught in different ways. And I think there's more, men being taught at a younger age that like vulnerability is okay and like feelings are okay. But I do think it's just been smashed into men when they were young that like you cannot feel and you cannot cry and you have to be a man. And I think that is all the reason homophobia is so bad, more on the male side than the female side, and all of that. And I just think it's taking a really long time to undo that damage.
Yeah, and I think some countries are faster and better at building platforms to help encourage, facilitate people to express their gayness than other countries. My little cousin, it's I don't know how the cousin relationship works. So it's my cousin's son, so it's first cousin once removed or something, but he's openly gay. I think he's 19 or 20 years old. And he's in Canada, and it's totally cool to be gay in Canada. It's amazing. He's off in university and he's having a whale of a time. But he went to visit my cousin in the Ukraine, and it was Gay Pride Day. And he's saying, like, I want to go out and celebrate on Gay Pride Day. And my cousin's trying to say to him, look, bro, it's not as cool to be gay over here as it is in Canada. And they went anyway under much protest from my cousin. And he said it was just a horrific day, like, horrific. Police escorts, like, really feared for their safety all day. Trains having to, like, whisk them away to secret locations with buses picking them up. And he said it was horrendous. So
Yeah, I
where
mean it's incredible the amount of countries where you can still be arrested for being gay and being open about it. It's insane. Like I think sometimes we take for granted coming from the US where it's slightly more PC, depends on what part of the country you're in, but yeah, there's still some places that are very backwards. And I think over here, I mean, just being in around Europeans, there's still a lot of like negative gay slang and just like derogatory rhetoric that is swung around. And until people say, hey, you can't say that anymore, like you can't, unless people start standing up and saying that that's not okay, it's just going to continue to happen. And say you're a gay male cyclist and you're on a men's team and they're constantly like saying, negative things like about, yeah, just like a derogatory thing about a gay man. How are they ever going to come out when nobody is stepping up and saying, hey, dude, that's not okay. Like you can't say that stuff anymore.
yeah, I think words really matter. I was like talking to a friend the other day in a completely different context, but he was talking about financial crimes, and he labeled them as like white collar crimes. And I was like, dude, words matter. Like, when you put the word white collar on the crime, it somehow takes away from the second half of the sentence, like that it's now a diminished crime because it's white collar. It's like it's a crime. It's the same thing. But it's the same in this when it's, little digs, when it's constant slurs, that's compounding on somebody's insecurity. And that's, I think, what makes it very, very difficult for somebody unless they're very, very self-assured or in a culture that makes it easy to come out.
Completely. And I mean, it's the straight men that are going to have to help, normalize this and make it okay. And that just might take a while.
So, how did your journey from being a soccer player and an aspiring academic to saying, I love on your blog, I was reading your blog, and I'm not sure if you wrote it or was it like a ghostwriter, but it's like hung up our soccer cleats. I'm like, that's the most American term I've ever heard, because I used to be a soccer player as well. I'm like, we don't say soccer cleats.
What do you say? Football
Football boots.
boots. Yeah. Soccer cleats. Yeah, you know, I played soccer competitively from the time I can remember until I started university. And when I started university, I kind of had a choice of whether I could go academics because I got a scholarship for academics, or I could go play soccer at like a smaller school. And my other dream besides being a professional soccer player, which I kind of could see, I wasn't quite at the level I needed to be to make that happen. So I chose academics and went full gas into university and was pre-med, and that was kind of the goal. And then I slowly just started really to miss competition. I was like going in the field house at the university and just like running laps and like trying to beat people around the inside track just because I needed some competition. Like, and I did, yeah. And I missed kind of like that sporting world. And we had a friend at the time who rode bikes. And so I raced bikes, which I didn't even know was a thing. So I got my first bike, I think, when I was 19, almost 20. I think I turned 20 by the time I really started riding the bike. And yeah, I mowed lawns for a summer to buy like this super pink Cannondale.
Nice, you went with pink, going for the legal blonde stereotype.
I definitely went with the shrink it and pink it model of bike at the time. But I loved it immediately. Like I fell in love with it from the first time I rode the bike. And I didn't just get a bike to ride it. I wanted to race it like immediately, of course, because I'm so competitive. So then I just jumped in full gas and I never really looked back.
But isn't that such an exciting time? I remember I forged a application form in the bank. I told them I needed a car for university and I bought my bike with it. I think I spent like €2,000 on my first bike. And nice. It was like Dura-Ace 9-speed, and like I was just transitioning from being a soccer player where I was thought I was going to be a pro. And then that dream was like, okay, this is disappearing. And I started uni and I got the bike, but I had no peer comparison because I had no friends who were good cyclists. So, and my upward trajectory, you know, when you're getting started, it's so fast. You're literally like, I don't know where this could end. Like I could be unstoppable.
Yeah, that's the best part. I remember first long ride I did was like 14 miles and I thought it was like the hardest thing I'd ever done. But the race I wanted to do was 60 miles and it was like 2 weeks after I got my first bike. But yeah, the progression from your first bike to like how good you can get quickly is pretty incredible. But so are the bonks that you have when you first get a bike and you don't realize that you need to eat when you're riding a bike. Yeah.
Do you have any particularly bad bonks?
I just remember like having to stop at a gas station and feeling like I couldn't even like function well enough to like get a candy bar and take it to the register because I was just so spectacularly bonked. And you don't even know that it's hunger at first. Like it's just such a new feeling that you don't even know until you're a cyclist, I think.
I had one in Toronto. So I was quite experienced at this stage. I had, you know, done the amateur thing in France and now I was racing full time in the US and I was doing a training block in Toronto and I was so poor that I'd run out of money for food on a 6-hour training ride. And I remember like hands and knees going like, I'm not going to make it home. The lights are going out. And I had a Ziploc bag that I had my phone and my keys and stuff in. So I went into Starbucks and I get the honey and I squirt the honey into the Ziploc bag. And I'm literally licking it outside in the car park like a homeless man.
That was desperation.
Oh, it was grim. And people are like texting you going, oh, living the dream, bro, living the dream.
That's pretty incredible. That's a good bonk story for sure.
Oh, man, it was bad. But I suppose that's a good segue to you gave up, aspiring career as an academic. And, you know, my background, I went through university and, you know, I never got to a world tour level like you, but I qualified as a lawyer. And then I tried to do the cycling thing and then never really went back because I started just setting up businesses and little things like that. But you gave up a pretty solid career. Like when you're in academia, you know, there's the next step is, you know, an entry level wage. The next step is a mid-level wage. The next step is a partner. The next step is a good salary. It's a pretty nice career path and there's not much risk involved. You gave that up and you traded it for sport, which is a niche sport, and then you have women's cycling, which is a niche sport within a niche sport. How difficult was that to make that plunge?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when it was first happening, I didn't realize it. I think I just, because I'd grown up being obsessed with sport and being obsessed with like the idea of being a professional and to go to the Olympics and to compete. You know, I loved watching all sports, but like especially soccer. And I kind of grew up in the era of the 99ers, so like the first Women's World Cup team that was really, really good.
Mia Hamm.
And yes, Mia Hamm, Brandi Chastain, all those girls that were like my heroes and posters. And if I could have been a professional soccer player, that's the route I would have gone for sure, because I just loved that. But I had a similar kind of passion for like human biology and physiology. And I knew that that was something that I also really loved. So I was okay when I made that switch. I was really focused on my university and really focused on school. But then when I started cycling again, I did both for a while, and I still continued to love both. And sometimes I wonder, because, you know, I still am very fascinated by medicine, and I sometimes think maybe I'll go back. And it's a long career though, to get to like, it's nearly 12 years from start to finish, just to like get through medical school and to be a resident. So it's a long time. But at the same time, I would never change like what I've done and what I've got to see because of cycling. I think my life is incredibly different than it would have been had I gone the other path. But yeah, I don't regret it at all, because yeah, it's been pretty spectacular, this decision too. And I wouldn't know Olivia, so there's that.
And can you make, without prying too much and also tell me to fuck off if you don't want to answer, it's like, can you make a living as a female pro cyclist? And how many of the female peloton are making a living? Because we've seen, like, you know, there's, I suppose, public record of a lot of the girls are struggling.
Yeah, definitely. It right now, it really depends on the team you're on. If you ride for our team, you definitely can make a living. I would say most of the girls on our team make a wage that you could live on.
Is there a minimum wage in the World Tour?
Trek set a minimum wage the same as the men. So that's not a UCI rule, but Trek Segafredo did it before. I think the UCI is going to make it a rule in the next year or two that they're the minimum salary is equal to the men's minimum salary, but Trek went ahead and did that before they could make that rule.
That's cool.
We do have a minimum salary, but it's really low. It's like $21,000.
Yeah.
I think that's what the World Tour women's minimum is.
Are you seeing this thing? Like, I know I have friends who've raced for Italian teams and still ride at like Pro Conti level. And they'll get like a wage of 30,000 for the year. And then they'll say, oh, well, there's a 30,000 like compulsory contribution towards coaching for the year as well. So they have to give their full 30,000 back.
Eesh, that's pretty awful. I'm sure that's happening. I think I've been pretty lucky with the teams that I've raced on. I mean, when I started, yeah, my salaries were super low, and you definitely had to like climb your way up the ladder. And I still think there's a lot of women that are on top teams that don't make enough money at all.
I think that's fine. Like climbing your way up the ladder, there's an expectation. Like I raced in France for a division national team, and I got paid €50 a week. And it's like, it's shit, but you expect it. Like you're doing an apprenticeship, but there is an expectation that if you make it, like you've made it, you're at the top tier in world cycling. There's an expectation that if you make it all the way, you should at least be able to, you know, live a middle class life.
Yeah, and I think that is the way it is now in the women's peloton. I do think the girls at the very top they make enough to live, you know, better than a middle class life. Like they live at least on our team. I don't know. I can't really speak to.
You're just talking about Lizzie, aren't you? Just balling around in Lamborghinis.
It's so frustrating that salary is so taboo, and that it is like people can't talk about it, because I honestly think that if it wasn't so secret, girls would know what to ask for. But honestly, nobody knows what other people are making for the most part in the peloton, because it has been so taboo and so secret. And thankfully, the Cyclist Alliance, I think, did an anonymous survey so that at least you could see the ranges. Because I think not every female like in the peloton has an agent that can negotiate their salary. And I think those that have agents probably negotiate good salaries, but the girls that are just doing it on their own, I don't think they know what to ask for. So I often think they're underselling themselves a lot.
You want to benchmark it against like someone on another team. You go, well, I'm similar age, similar experience, similar Palmares, similar budget team. you know, I deserve 45, 50K, whatever it is.
Exactly. And it's funny because I'm reading Megan Rapinoe's book right now, and she's talking about how salaries in soccer obviously were horrendous and so much lower than the men's for so long. And there was also this thing where nobody talked about it. So she's like, if nobody knows what other girls are making, they don't know what to ask for and they don't know what to fight for. And it's a similar thing in cycling is, I think, yeah, even within our team, it's not like we don't ask each other what each other makes, but like, I kind of have an idea, but you still don't really know.
You see what car they're driving.
Yeah, that's the kind of the joke with the men's team. They're always like bringing their fancy cars around. And one of them asked one of the girls on our team, like, they asked Lizzie, what car do you drive? And she's like, I don't know, a black one. Whereas they're all like, I drive a Jaguar. I have this BMW with this many horsepower. And we, none of us really care about cars. So even if we made millions, I don't think a car would be what we spent our money on.
What's Ryan Mullen driving?
He came up here in a Beamer, so I don't know, some kind of BMW.
Flash prick.
Yeah, he's quite flashy.
He is flashy. I've had Ryan on the podcast a few times. He's always good fun.
Yeah, I bet.
So I think there's a problem in not just women's cycling, but there's a problem in male sports, in male cycling as well, with the way we're generating revenue, because really we're reliant on rich businessmen to nearly make charitable contributions to run these teams because they're not getting a return on investment. And I can't believe that we haven't gravitated to a place where, you know, compulsory in contracts is people's social followings going, well, look, Taylor has X amount of followers. She can help you shift, you know, this many bikes we estimate this year. And now they can peg that back to investments. And if it does go that way, which seems to me like a natural way for it to move to a better business model, I think the girls are just so well placed to make a lot of money because it's just so much easier to have a big following as a female athlete than a male athlete.
Yeah, it's true. We always kind of joke that like, and the marketing people on the team always kind of joke that it's easier to market the women's team and we're better at social media for whatever reason. I don't really know why.
You're just nicer to look at.
Maybe it is that. Maybe, I don't know. But, and I think, yeah, I think that would be a much better model for sure. The cycling model is broken when it really does. A lot of times it's just like a rich man that invests in the team. And that's so many teams, men's and women's. Thankfully, Trek is, I mean, I think we're really lucky because our main sponsor is super solid.
Yeah, Trek and Segafredo. Did you get a Janaba free Segafredo coffee machine for your house?
I have not, but I'm sure I could if I asked.
Oh, I want one. They're badass. Yeah. So have you been over to Ireland with Olivia riding? Olivia is Taylor's partner, who's former Irish national champion, Olivia Dillon, if anyone just is unsure of what the Olivia reference is.
Yes, I love Ireland. It's my favorite place to travel, and I'm not just saying that because you live in Ireland and you're Irish. I absolutely love it there, and I've been so sad because this is the first year and since I've known Olivia that we haven't gone to Ireland because of COVID, and I miss it so much. Like, love. I think it's my favorite place to train, even though the weather is absolutely shite. But yeah, it's so beautiful. Like, on a sunny day, there is not a more beautiful place than Ireland for sure. And I mean, she's from Mayo, so we ride around there a lot. And like, yeah, it's incredible. And her
Mayo's like a fairy tale.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Connemara and just, yeah, all those places, Achill Island. And yeah,
have you raced over her?
I did Rostamon once. That was really fun. Yeah.
How did you get on?
That was great. I won.
Oh, brilliant.
It was the first year, I think, in like 5 years that Olivia didn't win. And she was racing for the Irish national team. And I was just racing for like a composite team. And they had the joke that like three stages in and I was winning. And they were like, why did you bring her? Like, why couldn't you just put her on the hop on, hop off bus in Dublin and like let her be a tourist?
I love the idea of just world tour riders just rocking up to local races, and it's what's beautiful about our sport as well. Like, and we get it with the Irish guys to come home, like Nico Roach or Dan Martin or Ryan Mullen and stuff. When they come home, maybe they're home for the nationals, and they just decide to jump into like some shitty criterium on a Wednesday night, and
yeah,
you just rock up, and it's like all the cool kit, the cool bike, and you're like, oh, this is brilliant. because we don't get to play against Lionel Messi.
Yeah, no, it is one of the really cool parts about our sport is it's so like approachable, and it's so, I mean, you can connect in so many different ways. And yeah, I love jumping in just like local races, or I loved doing Rossamon, and there was some really good girls. It was one of my favorite races, actually, and just beautiful roads. And I got lucky. We had a whole week of sun. That never happens.
Never happens. You know what? I think like a good amateur, like a good Cat 1 amateur, can hold the World Tour guys on a flat for quite a while. But when they plot the nationals courses with like super steep 16%, you know, 1 kilometer kickers in it, it's just like impossible for the amateur guys to hold the World Tour riders.
That's brutal. That would be brutal.
What's your preparation coming along like for the season to come, or what's on the cards races wise for you?
Yeah, it's good so far. We were supposed to actually be racing right now. Our first stage race was supposed to be Valencia, but then it got postponed because of COVID, and Valencia was in lockdown for a little while. It's back open again. So we had one team camp in January here in Denia, and now we have another one because we didn't have the race. So yeah, two team camps and then a little bit of rest. And my first race is Strada in a couple weeks. But the team start with opening weekend, so Het Nieuwsblad should be fun to watch.
Nice. In good shape?
I think so, getting there. You know, it takes a little bit to come out of the winter and then get your snap back. But yesterday we did some speed work, and I was like, whoo, this is what it feels like to race again. So, yeah, I'm excited.
And so will you base yourself in Europe for most of the season?
Yeah, so we have a place in Girona, and I'll probably be there most of the year. Unless there's nationals, which I can't really see that happening in the US right now, I'll probably stay, yeah, in Europe for the whole season.
I absolutely love Girona. I try and get over. It's like you coming to Ireland. It's the longest period, I'd say, in the last 10 years that I haven't been to Girona because of COVID. So I normally try and get out like a good few times a year. So I'm very jealous of your place over there.
Yeah, well, if, you know, we're not there, it's all yours.
Taylor, thanks for taking the time to chat.
Yeah, no, it was great. Thank you.
And I'll pop all your Instagram handles and website, blog down below so you don't have to rattle them off now. So we will catch up soon.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you.
Cheers, Taylor. Hey everybody, it's Anthony again. Really quick, I want to invite you to join arguably the best thing I've ever put out inside the Roadman community. It's a challenge. It's a challenge called the 14-Day Kickstart Challenge. So regardless of where your fitness is at right now, this is going to be the catalyst for making you faster and making you leaner. I've created this challenge to take the guesswork out of everything. It's 14 days of training plans, regardless of what your level is. There's masters, beginner, advanced. There's meal plans, shopping list, and even a video course holding your hand and talking you through it all. So what I recommend you do right now is just stop everything, press pause on this audio, and go to roadmancycling.com/14-day, or check out the link in the bio. That's roadmancycling.com/14-day.